Welcome everyone to the Middle East Forum. My name is Erwin Hochberg and I'm chairman of the Forum's Executive Committee. We're pleased to host today Stephen Emerson, who will discuss, is jihad or outdated? How Islamists work the system. First, just a few words about the Middle East Forum, the think tank founded by Daniel Pipes in 1994. Our mission is to define and promote American interests in the Middle East and help the United States defend itself at home. Hallmarks of our work include explaining the threat posed by radical Islam, protecting free speech from Islamist lawfare, working for true Palestinian acceptance of Israel, monitoring the Obama administration's activities in the Middle East, strategizing to contain the Iranian threat, and critiquing the extremist orthodoxy that dominates Middle East studies at North American universities. In addition, today's event is part of a lecture series that we present in 5 cities. Also worth mentioning, the forum's 4 websites attract over 400,000 visitors a month, one of the largest number of any organization in our subject area. And I invite you to add your name to the email list at this event to receive Middle East Forum materials. I also hope you will consider supporting the Middle East Forum as a not-for-profit organization, and as you know, we rely upon tax-deductible contributions to maintain our activities, the scope of which I have described and is even broader than I have described to you in greater detail. I ask at this time that you please silence all cell phones and pagers, and please hold your questions and comments until the question and answer period after the session led by the Forum's Director, Daniel Pipes, which will take place right after Mr. Emerson's formal remarks. Please limit yourself during the question and answer period to questions related to today's topic. I will now turn the session over to my partner for the session and my partner in other respects as well, Joshua Landis, a member of the Forum's New York Board, who will introduce our speaker. Josh.
Thank you, Erwin. Good afternoon. It's a great honor to welcome all of you. I take special pleasure welcoming you to this space in the name of Jack Renner, a dear friend who my wife, Rhina, who's in the second to last row, and I had the pleasure of introducing to his wife some 11 years ago, one of the 8 shidduchim, or matches, that my wife and I have made. So we're very proud of that. Jack is in Europe, but is ably represented by his colleague who is just up here inviting those to look around. He is possibly the world's most noted poster dealer. And I want to thank the 2 Shargels in my life, Terry from his office, and Amy Shargel, who so ably worked on this event for Middle East Forum. We are in for a great treat because we are going to hear from 2 giants of America, giants of truth-telling, brave men who tell it as it is. Of course, Daniel Pipes and Steve Emerson, who we'll hear from very shortly. I personally had a great recent experience with Steve Emerson. When I was walking on Madison Avenue, I felt a gun in my back. In fact, it was Steve Emerson's thumb. He then said, "Where are you off to, Josh?" I said, "I'm off to my office." "Why?" He said, "Come with me to NBC and pretend that you're my security guard, and you'll get to see me interviewed on TV." I did so. My business partner, Nelson, is here, so I admit, Nelson, I wasn't in the office then. I was doing that. I also want to thank Nelson for helping to host this today. But it was a great thrill, and I would have thought that some of the people who pushed Steve Emerson's life in peril when he said, Josh, you're my security guard, you know, that was tongue-in-cheek, until my wife and I live in Riverdale, New York, and our synagogue, it was our synagogue that was recently targeted in a bombing. So this stuff is closer than we all want to believe, as we all know. We'll hear more about that today. A few other housekeeping issues. I want to just invite anyone who might be interested, before I introduce Steve in one moment, after the program, I recently made a financial commitment, along with others, additional to what I do for the Middle East Forum, not cannibalizing my annual gift, but additional money for a new initiative that is being started that I so respect. Steve Rosen, whose name might resonate with all of us, as the man who really had unfair charges waged against him by U.S. Authorities, who has been vindicated, will be leading an office, an initiative in New York, in D.C., in Washington, D.C., in our nation's capital, related to the Middle East Forum. It was my honor to write a meaningful check there. Anyone else who would like to know, if Sam Solomon just walked in, join me in writing a meaningful check. Anyone who would like to know more about that, of course, can speak to me. Daniel Pipes, who is the brainchild behind that, you know, knows even more information, but it's an excellent initiative. Now to our speaker, Steve. Steve Emerson is one of the leading authorities on Islamic extremist networks. He's also a keen observer of Islamist trends, from violent jihad to the more recent phenomenon of lawful Islamism, which he has been closely monitoring and documenting. He serves as the executive director of the Investigative Project on Terrorism, one of the world's largest storehouses of archival data and intelligence on Islamic and Middle Eastern terrorist groups. Emerson and his staff frequently provide briefings to U.S. government and law enforcement agencies, members of Congress and congressional committees. Since 9/11, Emerson has testified before and briefed Congress dozens of times on terrorist financing and Islamist operations of Al-Qaeda, Hamas, Hezbollah, Islamic Jihad, as well as aspects of lawful Islamism in America. Emerson is the author or co-author of 6 books on terrorism and national security, including Jihad Incorporated, A Guide to Militant Islam in the U.S., which is available for purchase and signing at today's event. Please join me in warmly welcoming an American hero, in my opinion, and others, Mr. Stephen Emerson.
I'll be sure to report that to your bosses, which will terminate your career. why it's dangerous to rely on second-hand information from informants. And I told those assembled at the conference about a story about a monk who joined a monastery, and his first assignment was to copy the copies of the scriptures. And as he's copying them, he thinks for a second and says to himself, if I copy the copies, as has been done every generation, and there's a mistake in them, I'm only going to be replicating the mistake. So he goes to the senior monk and he says, you know what? Let me copy the original scriptures, because if there's a mistake in the copies I'm doing, we're only going to be replicating the mistake. Let's look at the original scriptures. So the senior monk said, that's a great idea. He goes down to the vault to compare the copy with the original scripture. He disappears for an hour, two, three, 4 hours. Nobody hears from him. So the young monk goes down looking for the senior monk and finally comes near the vault and hears this sobbing, this wailing, crying, and he sees the senior monk pored over the original scriptures, just wailing his heart out. And he asks the senior monk, what's the problem? And the senior monk responds, the word was celebrate. Right, that was a joke. This morning, I appeared on MSNBC to talk about the president's speech, and I was asked about the reaction that might be anticipated, whether this would result in a diminution of terrorism, what was the reaction of Islamic terrorist groups, and the reaction in the street. And I said that it's really too soon to tell, but I said when the president issued proclamations saying that Hamas must stop its violence, I said it's a rhetorical statement that has no teeth to it. I said that doesn't mean anything to Hamas. They're certainly not going to stop their violence because he says that they must stop it. So I concluded that Islamic terrorist groups are going to continue to carry out attacks no matter what. This is not going to change the war on terror. I said, incidentally, and I added this specifically, that radical Islamic groups in the United States were rejoicing at the president's comments this morning. At which point the anchor woman, Nora O'Donnell, says, that's idiotic. She assumed that I was talking about Al-Qaeda, that Al-Qaeda and other terrorist groups were rejoicing. I said, no, I'm not talking about Al-Qaeda, but I'm talking about Muslim Brotherhood-derived groups that feign moderation, but are actually derived from Islamic terrorist organizations. Those are the groups that when they hear the president say, I'm going to relax the restrictions on monies given by American Muslims to Zakat, meaning Islamic charities, they're the ones that think that the anti-financial restrictions and laws that were enacted over the past 8 years are suddenly going to be unraveled. And in fact, a certain Islamic group participated in providing guidelines to the president's speech and was exceptionally ecstatic at the comments made indicating that American Muslim groups would somehow have the stigma that has been attached to them for their radical statements made over the past decade suddenly erased, and they would be welcomed into the White House. That wasn't a statement that was made specifically, but a conclusion based on their interpretation of the president's comments. The president also made a statement, as Daniel pointed out in the blog this morning, the president referred to 7 million American Muslims. That is a fact, quote fact, that was taken from the Council on American Islamic Relations, the equivalent of taking race relations data from David Duke. There aren't 7 million American Muslims. There are more like 2 million or even less. Even the Pew poll showed last year that there were less than 2 million or maybe 2.3 American million Muslims. The other day, in a French interview, the president said that the United States had one of the greatest, was one of the greatest Muslim countries in the world. I'm still trying to figure out what that means. I think, based on what I've seen and what you have heard, I think we are seeing the unraveling of the consensus that started to develop about the dangers of radical Islam. Not terrorism per se. Everybody understands what terrorism is. Everybody understands what violence is. Everybody understands what happens when planes get flown into buildings and people jump from the 90th floor. Terrorism is equated with threat or jihad. What people don't understand is everything that goes into terrorism that's invisible, the recruitment, the indoctrination, the proselytization, the training, the fundraising. Much of that is legal. And much of that I call part of what is the stealth jihad. Jihad being holy war, interpreted commonly as holy war, it could also mean other things, but it's used by terrorists as a holy war concept. A stealth jihad is a much more sophisticated concept involving efforts to use the system, the American system or the Western system of freedoms and values, exploit them for purposes of infiltrating or subverting or intimidating Americans or changing the American system by affecting our values such as freedom of the press and freedom of speech. There are many examples that abound about how radical Islamic groups have changed the paradigm of free speech in the United States in the last decade. And yet, Americans don't seem threatened by anything less than the act of violence. And I would suggest to you that the act of violence is very dangerous, and terrorism, of course, is something that has to be prevented. But the other type of jihad is just as dangerous and more insidious, because it is invisible, it is hard to document, much of it is legal, and it's used and exploited under the rubric of simply expressing free speech or using the ballot box. Yusuf al-Qardawi, a leader of the Muslim Brotherhood, in 1995, in Toledo, Ohio, gave a speech, which we take and it's in Arabic. And what he said in the speech, and I'm paraphrasing, he said, we will win, we will conquer America. We will conquer Europe, we will reconquer Europe. You know, and he, realizing that reconquering Europe means returning to Andalusia and restoring its true ownership to the Muslims. He said, we will reconquer America, we will conquer America not through the sword, but through Jihad of Dawah, D-A-W-A. Dawah refers to proselytization, recruitment, conversion, the ballot box, immigration, all of the legal tools available to any group in Western society that wants to change Western society. The very freedoms that every ethnic group uses in this country when they come here in order to establish their presence and to gain political clout. His comment was very revealing because his purpose in saying this was, we don't want to carry out violence here. We want to carry out a campaign of nonviolence to achieve the same goal as what violence would achieve. It's the same reason why the Muslim Brotherhood condemned 9/11, which of course its apologist groups in the USA proves that the Muslim Brotherhood is moderate. But they condemned 9/11 not because it was immoral, but because it was counterproductive. And there's a big difference. A woman named Dalia Mohammed, works for Gallup, was just appointed to an interfaith advisory board by the President of the United States. In an interview in an Egyptian newspaper published this morning, she was asked about her role and her faith in being a Muslim advisor to the President of the United States. And this is what she said. Dalia said, She is serving Allah and Muslims before anything else. Now, that's not an illegal statement, but I think that tells us something about the agenda and the priorities of radical Muslims who say in moderation, play by the rules, don't commit anything illegal, claim they are simply operating as victimized ethnic members of a minority, and yet, in this particular case, demonstrate a loyalty not to the United States, not to the separation of church and state, not to the values of Western civilization, but to Islamist values. And therein lies the danger. The danger of being loyal and promoting an agenda that is an Islamist agenda, one that sees publications of books, such as a book published by Random House last year on the Prophet Muhammad's wife, destroyed and canceled because of letters from prominent Islamic clerics telling Random House that publishing the book would be injurious to their health. It's the same reason why only two U.S. newspapers in the United States republished the Danish cartoons. Yes, the New York Times had a wonderful editorial saying, we're not publishing it because we're being responsible. No, the reason was that editors and publishers at the New York Times don't want to have to look in the rearview mirror when they go home. The real reason why criticism is stifled about radical Islam, whether it's in newspapers, whether it's in publications, whether it's on radio stations, and there have been cases of anchors on stations fired for their comments, is because of a fear. What is that fear based on? The fear is one based on a perceived threat of violence. One doesn't have to be threatened with violence to feel the threat of violence. And I think that lesson was learned, obviously, after the Salman Rushdie episode, and has manifested itself numerous times in Europe, reinforced every several years with an act of violence, such as the killing of Teddy Van Gogh, a Dutch filmmaker. So much so that other filmmakers will refuse to touch the same subject that Mr. Van Gogh did for fear of being assassinated. It is that intimidation that exists, and in fact existed when I first started and embarked on my career in looking at radical Islam. In 1993, when I was working for CNN as a correspondent, I was asked to do a documentary on the first World Trade Center bomb. And when I proposed to CNN executives that I look at the radical Islamic groups, from Hamas to Islamic Jihad, that had transplanted themselves on American soil, this was back in 1993, under different innocent-sounding names, such as the Islamic Association for Palestine, or the Islamic Committee for Palestine, or the Palestine Committee, whatever. The reaction from CNN executives was, we're not interested in your documentary on that thesis. Why, I asked. They said, it's too politically sensitive. And that was my first, experience with being told, and I guess naively realizing, that political sensitivity has everything to do with editorial decisions. Hell has no fury like a journalist storm. I quit CNN and finally produced a documentary that aired in 1994 called Jihad in America. Public television aired it, but because of, quote, pressure by Islamic groups such as the Council on American Islamic Relations, and I'll come back to that group in a second, PBS ordered a wraparound hour to accompany the broadcast of that film. A wraparound is a 1 hour that involves a discussion of the subject or the film with members of other organizations that would disagree with you. So on that program, that wraparound hosted by Charlie Rose, was a woman named Anissa Al-Fatah, Abdurrahman Al-Amudi, and amputee members, all of whom were presented as representatives of moderate Islamic organizations, and contested the film as somehow being racist, even though the film specifically pointed out the existence of these groups with documents and undercover video, and interviewed moderate Muslims like the late Saif Ashmawi, who hailed from New Jersey and tragically died several years ago, but who also criticized the existence of these groups for their duplicity and for their inherent radical agenda. It turns out, if one looks at history, that Mr. Al-Mahmoudi, who was then the head of the American Muslim Council, is now serving a 23-year sentence for his involvement in a plot, an al-Qaeda plot, to assassinate the leader of Saudi Arabia. Anissa al-Fatah is a woman who was a board member of the Council on American Islamic Relations, whose major contribution to society is publishing diatribes against Jews who she contends were responsible for 9/11. M.T. Mehdi, who no longer is alive today, is infamous for his book that he wrote that Robert F. Kennedy deserved to die. These are the three men, these are the three individuals that public television selected to represent the other side. I wish I could say to you that public television and the media have changed. They haven't. Islamic radical groups pretending to be moderate continue to be legitimized and to be have respectability conferred upon them, from the Islamic Society of North America to the National Association of Islamic Trust to the Council on American Islamic Relations. Interestingly enough, the Council on American Islamic Relations was just deemed a front for Hamas, and the FBI severed its relationship with CAIR in December 2008. That was a major 180-degree reversal of policy for the FBI, because in the 14 years since CARE had been created in 1994, the FBI, present company excluded, had embraced CARE under the banner of outreach, sponsored dozens of interfaith outreach sessions, paid for trips by CARE officials to visit FBI offices around the country and conduct cultural sensitivity sessions, conducted joint town conferences, treated CARE as if it was the Islamic equivalent of Hadassah. Now, one could understand if the deception lasted for a year or two or three. The deception lasted for 14 years. And what is particularly aggravating is that in 1993, the FBI wiretapped secretly a meeting of a dozen radical Islamic Muslim Brotherhood leaders in Philadelphia. And at that three-day meeting, those individuals who were known to the FBI as suspected terrorists discussed and planned the creation of a public relations front group that would create a new face for Hamas in the United States. Three of the incorporators of CARE attended that meeting at which the FBI had wired that. A year after that meeting was held in Philadelphia, CARE was created directly in accordance with what transpired at the Philadelphia meeting. FBI officials who had translated the recordings knew exactly that CARE was created by Hamas. And yet, because of reasons that are related to the bureaucracy of the FBI, because of the stovepipe relationship, because of political correctness, because of a naivete, because of a desire not to offend, CARE was embraced as a legitimate civil rights Muslim organization that achieved incredible notoriety to the point of establishing 32 chapters around the country by December 2008. CARE is not the only group embraced by the FBI or the Department of Justice or the Department of Homeland Security. Last year, the Department of Homeland Security issued a memorandum What did the memorandum say? Anyone working for the Department of Homeland Security or the Department of State is no longer allowed to use the term Islamic terrorism or Islamic militant. You can only use the word terrorism. And in fact, you will find today that the President of the United States in his speech this morning did not use the term Islamic terrorism and has never used the term Islamic terrorism in either his campaign or in his 5 months as president. He's used the word extremist or terrorist, as if the generic term applied uniquely to Islam. Well, in fact, it doesn't. There are eco-terrorists, there are white terrorists, there are anti-abortion terrorists. Each one of them has a certain adjective or adverb attached to their name, terrorist, to describe or inform their behavior. And unless one describes the nature of what motivates the terrorists, then the use of the term terrorism loses all meaning. You can't identify your enemy by who he is. You can't expect to defeat him. And so the refusal to use the term Islamic terrorism is basically a manifest declaration of defeat by those who say they want to win the war on terrorism. The argument being, they use the word Islamic terrorism, you're afraid of stigmatizing the entire community. Well, when I was on Hannity and Combs, when Combs was still one of the co-anchors, and by the way, when I was asked a couple of years before whether I believed in enhanced interrogation techniques for Guantanamo prisoners, I said, no, just make them listen to Alan Combs for 2 hours. So when Alan Combs said to me that the use of the term Islamofascism was racist, I said, how about the term Islamic militant? He said, racist. I said, how about the term Islamic terrorist? He said, racist. So I said, how about the term white racist? And he shut up. The fact is, as you can see in the last week, the amount of coverage focused on the assassination of the doctor who performed the abortion was 100 times greater in news coverage than the assassination carried out by the jihadists in Little Rock, Arkansas. And there's a reason for that. Not because news editors say, well, there's not enough information. It's because of reluctance to talk about Islamic terrorism as Islamic terrorism. And I think, unfortunately and tragically, what that ends up doing is that it allows Islamic terrorists to flourish and takes away the onus of responsibility from Islamic communal leaders to repudiate Islamic terrorism by name. You know, people ask all the time, what's the percentage of Muslims who are terrorists? You know, and nobody has an easy answer. The public opinion polls aren't going to tell you that. So let's say it's 1%, let's say it's 0.1%. Well, 0.1% of 1.2 billion people is still a lot of people. But there's another question. How many Muslims in the United States or Europe believe but don't carry out jihad, believe in the use of suicide bombs? I call them the cultural jihadists. They're the ones that say it should be criminal to criticize the Quran. It should be criminal to print a cartoon of the Prophet Muhammad. It should be criminal to criticize the Sharia. That's the same proposal being asked to be implemented by the Organization of Islamic Conference, an organization that the United States just appointed an official representative to. I think we are heading down a terrible, dangerous course. Not because of the threat of terrorism. Terrorism is easily observed and recognized. In fact, if anything, an act of terrorism, the FBI is guilty of one thing. It's guilty of its success. When an act of terrorism doesn't occur and is prevented, the American public doesn't have an opportunity to see the violence that could occur. Can you imagine what would have happened on September 10th, 2001, if 19 people were... Amy's giving me the zero sign here. Okay. Students will start throwing tuna sandwiches at me. If on September 10th, 2001, 19 men were arrested and charged with conspiracy to blow up the World Trade Center and the Pentagon? I would say to you, if I were a betting man, they would all have been acquitted. Their defense would have been, this was just bluster, this was just talk, there was no evidence of it. And so it took 3,000 people to be killed before we suddenly realized we had a threat. In 1993, when John Anticev and Mike Anticev and Frank Pellegrino were investigating the World Trade Center bombing, not so far from here, only 7 people were killed. And because only 7 people were killed, the difference between that and the one that occurred 8 years later being 2,994, we didn't think Islamic terrorism was a problem. And now, in 2009, 8 years later, somehow the threat has dissipated. The threat exists. It will continue to exist. The act of violence is not what I am worried about, although I'm certainly very concerned about it. What I am worried about, and what I think the American public should be worried about, not just Jews, not just supporters of Israel, it should be affecting everybody who is concerned about the separation of church and state, about freedom of speech. The ability of radical Islamic groups to change the curricula of textbooks, to change what goes on the website of the State Department, to change the recognition of Islamic groups as civil rights groups, to engineer U.S. government support for radical groups that believe in jihad, to elect representatives of the United States, and there are 30 U.S. congressmen and congresswomen who today have stated their allegiance is to the Council on American Islamic Relations, despite the fact that it is an unindicted co-conspirator in the Hamas case and the fact that it was deemed officially a front for Hamas. There are 30 U.S. congressmen who have dictated their allegiance to that group, even after all the evidence that has come out. Votes, donations, political pressures, demographics, whatever you want to call it. These groups understand how to exploit the system. They also understand how to intimidate the media. You know, people ask me, do I think the media is in collusion with Hamas? I wrote an article about 5 months ago after the Israeli war with Gaza, in Gaza, which was, why does the New York Times love Hamas? And I looked at their story for the previous several years about that, how had they underreported Hamas radicalism, had portrayed Hamas as a social religious group, had tried to humanize Hamas, had never called Hamas even a terrorist organization. It categorically stated, we won't call Hamas a terrorist group because we don't have enough information. I don't know what other information they need to call Hamas a terrorist group. But if killing 1,000 Israelis in suicide bombings isn't enough information, I don't know what is. The extent to which radical Islamic groups have been able to manipulate, intimidate, or collude with sympathetic journalists is at a staggering level, a point at which the public is simply not made aware of. And I can tell you this partly because we have informants and we have intelligence that proves the extent to which radical Islamic organizations, feigning moderation, have been able to infiltrate the media and even the U.S. government. When I talk about this sometimes, people say, you're talking about conspiracies and you're looking for, you're being paranoid. I wish I were being paranoid. I'm going to end my talk and then take questions, pointing from a document that was found in the home of a man named El Barassi, who was arrested several years ago in Chesapeake Bay for first suspicion of supporting terrorist organizations. He was later convicted in a Chicago Hamas trial. In his home were tens of thousands of pages of documents that were never known to have been existed before. They were Muslim Brotherhood documents. The Muslim Brotherhood is the parent organization of all terrorist Sunni groups. The Muslim Brotherhood was founded in the 1920s. It professes today to be anti-violent, but it is not. It is the mother of Hamas, Islamic Jihad, and Al-Qaeda. But this one memo, among many, stood out. And I want to read to you just one paragraph, which I believe is probably one of the most important paragraphs in national security in the last 50 years since the communist threat. The memo was written on May 22, 1991, and it was an explanatory memorandum on the general strategic goal for the Muslim Brotherhood in North America. The relevant paragraph is as follows. Understanding the role of the Muslim Brotherhood in North America. The process of settlement is a, quote, civilization jihadist process with all the word means. The Ikhwan, the Muslim Brotherhood, must understand that their work in America is a kind of grand jihad in eliminating and destroying Western civilization from within and sabotaging its miserable house by their hands or the hands of the believers, so that it is eliminated and Allah's religion is made victorious over all other religions. It is the Muslim's destiny to perform jihad and work and carry out jihad wherever he is, wherever he lands, until the final hour comes. Without this, the Mujahideen will not be able to rule the world. This is the strategic cornerstone of the doctrine the Muslim Brotherhood seeks to employ, advance, and enforce in the United States and in Western Europe. If one wants to look into the future, I always say I can't predict the future of terrorism, but it's easy in this case. Look at Europe. Look at the degree to which the Sharia is now implemented in local communities. Look at the extent to which law enforcement, such as Scotland Yard and MI5 themselves, has been infiltrated by radical Islamists. Look at the extent to which local communities have, local politicians have accepted jihadists as partners for dialogue in Belgium, Italy, Germany, Denmark, and elsewhere. Yes, there's a much greater concentration of radical Islamic population in Europe. We haven't reached that point yet. But understand that that's the goal they seek to advance. Daniel has written very extensively eloquently about this threat. But it is a threat that affects everybody. Because the denial of free speech, the inability to publish a book, the inability to express one's views, the inability to make a prosecution, as my colleagues here in the FBI would admit that they weren't in the FBI, the inability to close down a terrorist front, the inability to serve justice because of the pressure and intimidation of radical Islamic groups is a danger to all of us. And unless we act and recognize this danger immediately and become a counter-terrorist lobby, because no such thing exists today, the future is bleak. So if there's one message I leave all of you with, it is to become involved. I'm very gracious that you all attended this meeting today, but to become more involved in contacting your congressmen, your senators, in putting pressure on your local newspapers, in putting pressure on local representatives, in ensuring that they're made aware of the threat that we face, and that you yourselves will count as a countervailing weight against the pro-terrorist lobby that exists under the facade of being civil rights organizations. Unless and until we can identify the enemy as radical Islam, we have no hope of defeating it. And if we can and do identify the enemy, then we do have a chance of defeating it in the future. We are grateful for moderate Muslims that have existed. Sufi Zaidi is here. Her father, a magnificent man who passed away tragically several years ago. We are looking for others. They do exist. They are the ones that should be empowered and legitimized, not the speakers for care. Anyway, now I think my opportunity is about to be cut off, so I hand over the microphone to Dan.
Hamza Yousef, on September 9th,
September 9th, 2001, had given a speech in California warning that the United States would be destroyed unless he listened to the words of Allah. When we gave this tape to the FBI several days after we had obtained it, and this was after 9/11, they immediately went to the house of Hamza Yousef to interview him because it seemed to indicate he might have some premonition about what was going to happen. He didn't. Still, his radical ideology, the thoughts, the expressions of support for Hamas that he has continued to make, has not stopped him from being invited to the White House, has not stopped him from being lauded on National Public Radio, has not stopped him from being represented as a true moderate. So I don't know what it would take. You know, one of the problems is, just 60 seconds longer, is that the FBI's role and the government's role is limited to the point that it can act against something that is clearly illegal. It's not illegal to lie. So if David Duke wants to say that he's really a civil rights group, he can say that. No one would accept it because they know he's lying. But if an Islamic terrorist group, or one that supports terrorism ideologically and serves as a propaganda arm, says they're really a civil rights group, it's not the government's role to come and say, no, you're lying. It's up to the media, the Fourth Estate. And since the Fourth Estate was not doing its job, that was one reason I created the Investigative Project on Terrorism, to look into and expose the deceit perpetrated by these radical Islamic groups that were feigning moderation, that were getting away with murder. And I think that problem we still face today is the inability and unwillingness of journalists, of nonprofit groups, of think tanks, look, the Brookings Institution, routinely invites stealth jihadists to give lectures. There are chaplains at major universities such as Georgetown that have employed former members of Hamas, and they send them now overseas to be goodwill ambassadors for Islam. On the website of the FBI, on the home page 2 weeks ago, the director of the FBI gave an award to a man, a chaplain named Yahya Hendi, who is the chaplain at Georgetown, Islamic chaplain at Georgetown, as a man of peace and for his interfaith work and all that. Now, I know he speaks a nice name today, and some of my best friends are friendly with him. But Daniel is also aware of Yahya Hendi's background. Mr. Hendi served on the board of the Council on American Islamic Relations and the United Association for Studies and Research, the strategic arm of Hamas. He has spoken for Hamas. He has spoken for radical Islamic groups such as the World Assembly of Muslim Youth and has made anti-Semitic statements. And yet this man somehow transformed himself into a man of peace and dialogue and became an honoree of the FBI director. When I pointed this out to an assistant FBI director, he looked down and said, Steve, looks like we didn't do our vetting properly. Well, the fact is they didn't do their vetting properly, and this happens all the time.
One last thing, a quick practice question. 8 years ago, the U.S. government had urged us to use a little bomb to the Russian radical Islam. And so it was not surprising and it was understandable that there was a lot of confusion in the days after 9/11. But now it seems to be over. And it's confusing. 8 years later, they're still trying to make the same points. They're still the same confusion. And judges are like, they speak in power, there have been more confusion. So it doesn't feel like you've done anything. But to me, it feels like pre-9/11. All that was learned is now being unlearned.
Let me just make one comment here. When I refer to the FBI, you know, there are 30,000 members of the FBI. There's three of them are here today, okay? There are a lot of people in the FBI. There are agents in the FBI who get it, who understand the problem. And yet, unfortunately, their words, their admonitions, their caveats, their knowledge is not being used, it's being ignored, and I think it's to the credit of those that are here today that understand the threat of radical Islam, both self-jihad and the real jihad, that gives you an idea that there are still people within the FBI that get the message and want to do the right thing, and they stand out for their courage. Well, we've seen in the last few years this cross-fertilization where Iran now has exquisite disproportionate control over Hamas and the Islamic Jihad. So you have a Shiite radical country exerting influence over two Sunni terrorist groups. That's number one. Number two, in the United States, interestingly enough, under the dictum, the enemy of my enemy is my friend, we've seen a convergence between, let's say, the Muslim Student Association and the Muslim Student Association Persian Study Group, PSG. That's a different organization, and yet, if one is Shia, the latter being Shia, the former being Sunni, we've seen a convergence of operations because of the belief that they're in the land of the infidel, and that's the common enemy. We're coming out with a report in about a month about the presence of Hezbollah in the United States. And it's based on interviews and declassified documents we just obtained in the Freedom of Information. What it shows is an extensive network of Hezbollah activists and terrorists in the United States that, as opposed to the Sunni groups, prefer to remain under the radar screen and not exert their influence politically. What they use the U.S. for primarily is for fundraising, recruitment, operational controls, as a safe house, but they're not willing to assume the same level of political profile as, let's say, the Sunni groups such as CARE or ISNA. That's a big difference in terms of their behavior in the United States. But under the radar screen, and as you can see obviously in the Middle East, there is tremendous collaborative relationship between the two organizations, the two religious organizations.
Thank you so much, Steve. It's been a while to get you here. Thank you for what you've made it. As always, on the news still today, we have copies of his most recent books. We have available for sale in the back of the van. Most grateful. It is the two of us who were feeling very lonely 10 years ago before 9/11. Felt very exposed. I'm happy to say that there are a whole lot more people involved in this subject area. It doesn't feel longer than what you see. But as I said before, it does feel like we're moving backwards.
Okay, can I just say one thing here? I think.
You go.
10 seconds.
Yeah.
10 seconds here.
Yeah.
I just sort of funny. When Charles Krauthammer was recently asked whether he feels threatened by the commentaries he has made attacking Hamas and Islamic groups, he says that every morning he reads the newspaper, and if he doesn't see the obituary of Steve Emerson and Dan Pipes, he feels safe. So I just want you to know that. Dan and I have been out there for a long time.
Again, thank you.